Good morning, all. Welcome. This is the business meeting of the Judicial Council of California, December 14th, 2012, our 12th meeting of this year. The meeting is now in session. As you know, this is the continuation of the two-day council session that began yesterday with the presentation of the council's 2012 Distinguished Services Award and the Benjamin Aranda III Access to Justice Award, the latter award co-sponsored with the California Judges Association, the State Bar, and the California Commission on Access to Justice. It's always a pleasure to be able to recognize outstanding jurists, administrators, and lawyers for their unique talents and ongoing dedication and commitment to public service. And in the case of this year's awards, it was also a great and sobering opportunity to be able to recognize those who, with the special posthumous Stanley Moss Defender of Justice Award to Captain Matthew Patrick Manoukian, and all those who have made the ultimate sacrifice for the rule of law, those who serve in our armed services. A few housekeeping matters. I do remind Council that our meetings are audio cast live with real-time captioning on the California Court's website. For the benefit of Council members joining us by phone, Judge Elias, and the online audience, please speak into your microphone and address each other by name clearly so that listeners and real-time captioning readers can follow our discussion. And portions of these meetings are also routinely videotaped for later viewing and broadcast on the California Court's website.
The following participant enters the conference.
Emily Elias.
Good morning, Judge Elias.
Good morning. Sorry I can't be there. We had a big reception for Judge Edmund yesterday that I had to attend, but I'm here by phone.
Well, we thank you for attending by phone. I also understand we may have Senator Noreen Evans join us as one of our two representatives to Judicial Council from our sister branch, the legislature. But I also wanted to acknowledge former Assembly member Mike Fuhrer, who termed out of his Assembly seat, I believe, last week or this month, and therefore the Judicial Council. But we also want to thank him for his contributions to the work of this council and his advocacy on behalf of all Californians on the issues and bills he worked on and was involved with relating to equal access to justice. He, like Senator Evans, is a former honoree of the Stanley Moss Defender of Justice Award, and Mr. Fuhrer had served on this council since 2008. We wish him well in his future endeavors, and we look forward to welcoming a new member of our council nominated by the State Assembly to fill that position. The first matter on our agenda is the approval of minutes from our October 25, 26 meeting. Do I hear any amendments or a motion?
So moved.
Judge O'Malley, a second?
Second.
Second by Judge Rosenberg. Any discussion? Hearing none. All in favor of approving the minutes, please say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Matter passes. Next come a series of reports before we hear public comment. I start with the Chief Justice's report. And that is a report of to Council of engagements and ongoing outreach activities since our last meeting. Since our October meeting, I've continued to advocate for Judicial Council's number one goal of equal access to justice for all Californians and our priority of adequate funding for our judicial branch, doing so through a series of meetings and speaking opportunities with our sister branches of government, justice system partners, and the media. Apart from being responsive to general media inquiries on topics of importance that come up from time to time to our branch and issuing statement on budget issues, I had the opportunity to participate in two media relations activities during this period, one with the local media here, that is the editorial board meeting with the California Lawyer magazine, where we discussed funding and access issues. We also discussed potential topics for California Lawyer. So I do invite judicial council members or others who believe that there's an important topic that California Lawyer might consider. Please let me know, and I'd be happy to pass on your ideas when we meet with the editorial board. The other opportunity was a national press conference with the Conference of Chief Justices, where I had the opportunity to go to Washington, D.C. with Judge Jarre and also President of the State Bar, Patrick Kelly, along with the president of the co-president of the Open Courts Coalition, and that is Paul Kiesel. And we participated at the National Press Club to a series of conversations with a few other chiefs and legislators about the national crisis and the solutions to the national crisis of underfunding the judiciary. It was heartening, but also discouraging, I have to say, to share our stories with our sister states about access to justice. I've also continued to participate in what has been a very satisfying and, I think, effective collaboration and partnership with bar associations and attorney organizations. To name a few, I had the opportunity to participate with the West Hawaii Bar Association, the California chapter of the American Board of Trial Advocates. Mark Robinson met with him in Hawaii to talk about the advocacy and thank ABOTA for the work that they've done on behalf of courts and judiciary and the funding. The Asian American Bar Association, the Chancery Club of Los Angeles, along with my fellow justices last week, and also participation in the Sacramento Bar Association earlier this week. At all of these events, I see many of you and have the opportunity to share perspectives from the bench and from counsel, the boardroom, and to engage others with a rising awareness of the impact of 5 years of cumulative cuts to the branch. Also had the opportunity recently to have regular contact with our colleagues in the executive and legislative branches. During this period, I had a meeting with the governor. Attending with me were Justice Baxter and Judge Jarr. And on call for any detailed information, we had Corey Jasperson, our new OGA director, as well as LOTCO. We also will have an update on that later, I believe, on the judicial branch budget. I had the opportunity of administering the oath of office to Senator Evans' new colleagues in the California State Senate and meeting with Senator Steinberg. I think regularly administering the oath during this time of year is giving me a renewed opportunity to think clearly and deeply about what those words mean and our role as lawyers and judges and professionals who take that oath to uphold the Constitution of the California Constitution and the Constitution of the United States. This includes my report. I'll turn it over now for the report from Judge Jarr.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Good morning, members of the council. There's a fairly lengthy report that summarizes the activities of the administrative office under my name in your materials. I'd like to provide some highlights, some of which actually don't appear in the report. First off, I'd like to renew my delight at having now on board our new OGA director, Corey Jasperson, who is present, along with our new assistant director of the Office of Governmental Affairs, Teresa Taylor Carroll, each newly appointed as of December 3rd, although they both began before they came on the payroll, as everyone knows, given the pressing issues of the day that arose in recent weeks. Collectively, Corey and Teresa have more than three decades of experience working in the Capitol, in each of the two chambers of the legislative branch, and in other endeavors as well, which I think uniquely suit them to serve as our legislative advocates in times to come. We're fortunate to have their expertise, and also fortunate to have had such splendid assistance from Justice Baxter, who chaired the search committee, and Judge Rosenberg, who among your number was a member of that committee, to achieve such an outstanding and successful result. We're grateful to each of you and to your colleagues on the search committee. As far as the ongoing administrative office restructuring activities are concerned, a couple of quick highlights. Kurt Soderlund, our Chief Administrative Officer, and Kurt Child, our Chief Operating Officer, have collaborated together in the continued process of defining the roles of the real estate and facilities side of what formerly was the Office of Court Construction and Management, and the capital programs side, which is a concern, of course, with new construction. They're working closely with Bert Hirschfeld, who has, of course, responsibility for the real estate facilities and maintenance activities, and with Lee Willoughby, who remains responsible for facilities construction activity. The efforts are working smoothly, as I understand it. There are still a common necessary points of intersection, of course, between the two offices. in respect of programs that will continue to exist. But this logical separation of the two functions of construction and management is moving ahead appropriately. In addition, of course, as you are aware, the Court Facilities Working Group, chaired ably by Justice Hill, whose group was in session yesterday, and the Modification Working Group, chaired by Judge Power, continue to provide oversight for these offices. One, in fact, is the subject of your directive in today's meeting. A couple of highlights from the written report. Shelley Curran, who is managing our court criminal justice office, which itself was reorganized to address generally criminal law matters and specifically the challenges associated with realignment, has prepared a summary of the most recent reporting requirements for all post-alignment dispositions for inclusion in the individual criminal history reports. Recently enacted changes to parole and felony sentencing laws have created considerable confusion about disposition information that courts should report to the Department of Justice. The memorandum that Shelley's office is responsible for uniformly communicated the requirements to all courts, including reporting preferences that were revised over time. The grant-funded deployments of the California Courts Protective Order Registry, an award-winning program, which is currently in use in 21 court jurisdictions and 5 tribal courts, continues to improve the certainty that the existence of orders is well published and retrievable by any and all peace officers who require them for discharging their duties. 10 additional courts will deploy to the registry by June of this year under a grant-funded program by the California Department of Justice. Also noted in your materials is the existence of a new online publication on the subject of truancy and school discipline. It's intended as a resource for all our courts in working with justice partners and other stakeholders to develop collaborative solutions to these issues in their communities. The briefing cites key statistics and research on the intersection with juvenile justice and child welfare systems and identifies principles and strategies for addressing the problem. According to the State Department of Education, more than 400,000 California students were suspended in the 10-11 school year, some more than once, for a total of 750,000 suspensions. School suspensions are one of the leading indicators of whether a child will drop out of school, and dropping out of school, of course, increases the risks of incarceration. This is an issue on which, as everyone here knows, the chief is focusing attention on creating partnerships needed to return these children to their schools and to become productive members of society. Earlier this week, the chief provided a letter of support for the United States Senate Judiciary Committee, member Senator Dick Durbin, chair of the Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Human Rights, for a hearing he convened this past Wednesday dealing with the topic of what often is referred to as ending the school-to-prison pipeline. And that concludes my report, Chief.
Thank you, Judge Jarr. I don't see any hands for questions or comments. We'll turn this over then to the Judicial Council Committee presentations, beginning with Justice Baxter, Chair of the Policy Coordination and Liaison Committee.
Thank you, Chief, and good morning, members of the Council. I'd like to join Judge Jarr in welcoming Corey and Teresa on board. They found out very quickly there was no honeymoon period involved here. And I'd also like to thank Kurt and Donna for assisting in the transition. I'm confident, very, very confident, that Corey and Teresa will do an outstanding job on behalf of the Judicial Council and on behalf of the judicial branch. So, welcome aboard. The Policy Committee has met twice since the last council meeting, focused on our discussion from the October meeting on council-sponsored legislation. And specifically, the committee at its November meeting recommended council sponsorship of a legislative proposal focusing on cleanup of the newly enacted $30 court reporter fee enacted by the 2012 Public Safety Budget Trailer Bill. On November 29th, the Policy Committee met to consider sponsorship of a proposal to establish a pilot project authorizing trial courts to conduct remote video trials in cases involving traffic infractions and violations of the law on compulsory school attendance. And as you know, the reason for this legislation is because of court closures in the rural areas of our counties where access to justice is nothing more than a fiction. The legislative proposal relating to the court reporter, the court report fee, and other items recommended by the Policy Committee for Council sponsorship are items F through H on today's consent agenda and item R on the discussion agenda. The legislative proposal about remote video trials will be considered at a later Judicial Council meeting. At the November 15th meeting, the Policy Committee was also briefed on fiscal impact of legislation and status on proposals for efficiencies, cost savings, and new revenue. The committee also met yesterday in person, primarily to meet and greet our new director and assistant director, but we also had the opportunity to be briefed on budget-related issues. The legislature reconvened on December 3rd for the swearing-in of newly elected members, and they will reconvene the first week of January. So I'll update the council in future meetings as legislation is introduced, positions are taken, and council-sponsored legislation moves through the process. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Justice Baxter. And seeing no hands for comments or question, we'll hear from Justice Miller on the chair of the Executive and Planning Committee.
Thank you, Chief Justice. The Executive and Planning Committee has met seven times since the council's last meeting, by email four times, by telephone twice, and then I believe for the first time ever jointly with RUPRO yesterday. In the course of those meetings, the committee set the agenda for our council meeting today. And as part of that agenda setting, the committee held a consultation with those Judicial Council members who served on the Strategic Evaluation Committee to receive their assessment of the reports for this meeting documenting the implementation of the Judicial Council directives regarding AOC restructuring. And those reports, which are on our agenda for today, are item U on the issue of retaining the AOC Office of Security, information item 1 on the status of AOC implementation of Judicial Council directives on restructuring, and then as a result of our meeting, E&P in consultation with the three other council members added a new consent item for today's meeting regarding the AOC policy on working remotely. On behalf of the council, the committee acted on three separate requests for Superior Courts of San Diego, San Mateo, and Los Angeles regarding the conversion of subordinate judicial officer positions to judgeships, although one of the requests was to approve an exception to converting a position eligible to become a judgeship. E&P yesterday joined RUPRO in a meeting to review our current structure of existing Judicial Council advisory bodies, including advisory committees, task forces, working groups, and subcommittees. This is a part of our ongoing council initiative with regards to governance and evaluating the opportunities for consolidating committee activities, strengthening council oversight, reducing the costs associated with committee functions, and also making sure that they are aligned with our core functions as a judicial council. Regarding the status of progress made on the 145 Judicial Council directives concerning AOC restructuring, this is the second report from E&P on the AOC's implementation efforts. And I'm going to apologize right now for the length of this, but I think it is important that I review those. The last report was, as you know, provided to us at the October Council meeting. Item information one, included with your agenda today, contains my detailed and E&P's detailed report and status information on implementation efforts of the Administrative Director of the Courts and AOC in implementing the recommendations since the October meeting. In summary, AOC offices continue to make progress on the implementation of the AOC restructuring directives in accordance with the timelines for implementation approved by the Judicial Council. Highlighted in my report are four sets of directives raised for attention because they resulted in some modification in AOC implementation. Those four are, first, direction to the AOC to return to this meeting with recommendations for conducting cost-benefit analysis to determine the types of training and education provided for new judicial officers and others through the Center for Judicial Education and Research and Education Program, Directive 86. CJER staff is actively working on developing these recommendations and will provide the recommendations to the Council at the January 2013 meeting, with a final report at the April 2013 meeting. Number two directives related to financial practices for which the AOC requested permission at the October meeting to return to the Council at this meeting with a request to modify implementation, and this is again Directive 40 and 42. E&P approves of the AOC rationale and proposal for modifying the implementation approach for each of these two directives. One of these directives concerns the conditions for presenting requests for additional resources to the Council, Directive 40. The AOC agrees with the value of performing a cost-benefit analysis for funding augmentation requests for new or expanded programs and services and for large-scale projects. However, the AOC Fiscal Services Office has indicated that a cost-benefit analysis may not be practical for every request for branch funding, especially where the funding requests are for costs associated with health and retirement expenses, rent increases, or legislative mandated services. Additionally, the AOC has indicated that this directive will be part of a broader review and policy discussion along with other restructuring directives, 7 through 13, 21, 40, 91, and 145. Relating to the development of cost-benefit analysis proposal for the AOC, which is scheduled for Council review at a later date. The second directive concerns compliance with time requirements in the state budget process and the presentation of fiscal information to the Council, Directive 42. AOC Fiscal Services Office supports this directive and indicates that generally reported budget numbers will not change unless such changes are dictated by state fiscal reporting guidelines. Some flexibility may be warranted for those reporting provisions included in state fiscal reporting requirements. In addition, the Administrative Director of the Courts will propose a briefing calendar to advise the Judicial Council of any adjustments to previously reported numbers submitted by the AOC as part of the state budget development and fiscal reporting process. Three, the Council's directive to analyze and define the necessary emergency response and security functions for the branch and to prepare a recommendation on the organizational plan for Council approval, Directive 125, will be taken up in our discussion of Item U on the agenda for today's meeting. And fourth, the Council's directive to ensure compliance with the AOC's telecommute policy and return with recommendations at the policy this meeting, Directive 26, is also recommended for modification. E&P is proposing on today's consent agenda to expand the directive, in other words, expand what we approved previously, to include the question of whether a telecommute program should remain in force at the AOC at all. This issue will be deferred for a discussion by the Council at the February 2013 meeting. And finally, as I noted at the October Council meeting, the Administrative Director sees the need and has requested the Council's formal directive to take steps to ensure that AOC's policies and procedures are uniform, current, and accessible in an AOC policy and procedure manual as a consequence of restructuring activities. ENP has provided this direction and given a proposed timeline of October 2013 for the administrative director of the courts to report back on these activities. Also, at our recent meeting, when we met with the judicial council members that had previously been on the SEC committee meeting, we felt it necessary to establish a review policy so that we can document and ensure that the various implementation policies are moving smoothly and being implemented. The chief has, I believe, signed as of today the order with regards to your individual assignments as judicial council member liaisons to AOC departments. And ENP has graciously added another responsibility on your many others in performing those duties. And so what we're going to do as we, in consultation with the judicial council members from the SEC committee, review the various directives, watch their implementation and their completion, we're going to ask you as judicial council liaison members to the different AOC committees that when one of those directives concerns a division or department that you're involved in, we're going to ask you to further look and talk with them to document and ensure in a very unobtrusive manner that that has been accomplished and then report back to us. We feel that's important, that it's a natural and logical part of the process to make sure that the directives are completed. I do want to say in conclusion, though, in that regards, that as the chair of ENP, I have the opportunity to work almost daily, sometimes Saturday and Sunday, with the ENP staff that you're all familiar with, but also in a much broader context with almost every division and almost every person here at the AOC. And at least what I've personally witnessed is that they have great industry, integrity. They have been selfless in their public and spirited service to the AOC. They have done and always do a wonderful job and will continue to do that. So I want to personally thank the ENP staff and then the AOC staff for the process that we're going through and their willingness to ensure that we have a great structure and a great system. So thank you very much. That's my report.
Thank you, Justice Miller. I join in that gratitude, and I don't see any hands raised for comments or questions. We'll hear now from Justice Harry Holt, Chair of Rules and Projects Committee.
Yes, thank you, Chief. Good morning. Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. The Rules and Projects Committee has met four times by telephone conference call and has considered by email one proposal since the July count. The Judicial Council meeting on October 25th and 26th, and in addition, met in person in the joint meeting with ENP, to which Justice Miller referred a moment ago. RuPro met by telephone on November 19th to review proposed revisions to the civil jury instructions. RuPro recommends approval of this proposal, which is item A1 on today's consent agenda. On November 29th, RuPro met to review three rules and forms proposals that RuPro recommends for council adoption effective January 1st, 2013. They are items A2 through A4 on today's consent agenda. Two of the proposals, traffic, automated traffic enforcement system notice to appear, and civil forms, applications for and notice of stay and early evaluation conferences in construction-related accessibility claims, are recommended for adoption effective January 1st, to be consistent with statutory changes effective on that date, though the proposals have not yet circulated for public comment. RuPro approved the two proposals to circulate for public comment during the winter cycle after their adoption. Following public circulation and further review by the advisory committees and RuPro, the two proposals are expected to come before the Judicial Council at the April 2013 business meeting. The third proposal is also required to conform to new legislation, but involves only technical and minor substantive changes and therefore, under Rule 10.22 Subdivision D Subdivision 2, RuPro recommends its adoption without circulation for public comment. On December the 4th, RuPro met to review a proposal for a pilot project for remote video trials in traffic and compulsory school attendance cases. Because of various issues raised during the course of the comment period and afterwards, changes are being made to the proposal, which is now expected to come before the Judicial Council for consideration at our January meeting next year. RuPerot met on December the 7th to review 11 proposals to circulate for comment during the winter cycle. The proposals are required to comply with or implement recent legislation or to be consistent with recent case law. Following public circulation and further review by the advisory committees and RuPro, the proposals are expected to come before the Judicial Council at the April 2013 business meeting. In addition, on November 26th, by email, RuPro recommended for approval the 2013 Uniform Bail and Penalty Schedules, which is item A5 on today's consent agenda. I would like to add also that the combined meeting that Justice Miller referred to yesterday will be an ongoing effort between RuPro and E&P, and we expect to continue that course. That's my report, Chief. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Justice Hall. Not seeing any hands raised for comment or question. We'll hear from Judge Herman, Chair of the Technology Committee.
Thank you, Chief, and good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Since the last Judicial Council meeting, the Technology Committee and its individual members have been busy. The September Technology Summit, as well as follow-up meetings after the summit, with input from court administrators, judges, CIOs, as well as input from CTAC and branch technology staff, and particularly with input from the California Technology Agency, has verified that courts are looking for, are anxious for, in light of the current economy, improved technology solutions to support more cost-effective business practices given our current economic situation. But it's equally clear that technology funding sources are critically limited both at the branch and the court level, and of course will become even more limited as fund balances both at the branch level and the trial court level are reduced to 2% and 1% respectively. And moreover, this California Technology Agency has emphasized that the executive branch will not entertain funding requests for technology without a technology plan tied to a governance structure with a cost-benefit assessment. And accordingly, court and stakeholder collaboration, court and stakeholder collaboration on development of that plan is critical. And that plan, including the update of existing technology, strategic and tactical plans, must be our primary focus within our committee in line with the council's charge. Our committee activities since our last meeting have included biweekly checkpoint meetings for core technology committee members to further clarify issues raised by the technology agency and to address specific ongoing projects. The technology committee continues to work to develop a unified long-term plan to achieve funding stability for core technology, and this and other activities are in alignment with council direction and the SEC recommendations. On November 13, 2012, the committee met again with Mary Winkley of the California Technology Agency as a follow-up to the Technology Summit and the course and path forward. This meeting included a small group selected from the Judicial Branch Technology Working Group chaired by Judge Moss and included, of course, judicial officers, court executive officers, court information technology officers, and CTAC representatives to further the development of the planning process and to design a participant group. Now, the technology committee met on November 26, and the topics of that meeting included a request by the Kings County Superior Court on supplemental critical need funding to replace its failing case management system. Both staff and the chair have worked closely with Kings, and the technology committee has requested that Kings strengthen its business case and present to the council at its January meeting. The status of the California Court Protective Order, which has already been addressed by Judge Jarre, is also part of our discussions. The mandatory rules on e-filing that are being developed by the AB 2073 Working Group, of which I am vice chair, were also a topic of discussion. The vision and roadmap document from the work stream, one of the work streams of the Judicial Branch Technology Initiatives Working Group, is also a document that we spent some time discussing, and it includes and is in alignment with the survey to the trial courts on their technology needs as well as the SEC recommendations. The working group, as previously reported to the council, has assisted and advised the tech committee on various short-term technology issues as well as the roadmap document. The roadmap document and the other work streams developed by the working group will be key contributions to the technology planning effort. I might add that Judge Moss can verify this is a very active group. The various work stream components meet almost weekly, as well as the sort of steering committee of the group itself. And I much appreciate Judge Moss's assistance and contribution to that effort. The chair participated in the Court Technology Advisory Committee special meeting via teleconference on November 27, 2012. During the meeting, members of that committee voted and approved two items: the recommendation that the council adopt the remote video pilot project, which was addressed by Justice Baxter, also went through PCLC and RuPro. And at RuPro's direction, the project will be limited to traffic, and a number of procedural alterations will be incorporated, and the project will come back before the council in 2013. They also approved the recommendation to circulate the invitation to comment, amending rules of court, and to adopt forms to implement the mandatory e-filing AB 2073 project, and the target for the implementation date for rules and forms is an effective date of July 2013, which I might add is a very accelerated effort, because the legislature, I think, gave us 18 months to complete the rules and forms and report back to the legislature, and there's a lot of anxiousness in the trial courts to move forward with mandatory e-filing because of its cost effectiveness as far as trial court operations are concerned. So my compliments to the AB 2073 committee for the accelerated efforts that they've made in that regard. And additionally, the CTAC committee provided updates regarding the drafting of their annual agenda, which we will be subject to the tech committee's review and oversight in January. The as the council may recall, we authorized funding for replacement of San Luis Obispo's failing case management system. They have entered into a contract with Tyler Technologies for that system that was signed November 19th of 2012. Tyler Tech is one of, I think, two vendors that replied to their RFP. This will be the first Tyler Tech project in California. And, we reported last time on the sort of universal RFP that's been developed. So Tyler Tech is a vendor that is very interested in providing case management systems in California, and we'll all keep an eye on this project to see how it moves forward. The anticipated deployment date for the Tyler Tech a program in San Luis Obispo is the end of 2013 or early 2014. E-Court, which is a sustained product, that's another vendor that's interested in electronic-based management systems. Sonoma, Santa Barbara, Placer, and Tulare are in the process of transitioning up from the current Justice Edition to the E-Court Edition, which will provide document management and e-filing capability. Santa Barbara is scheduled to go live with the E-Court civil system at the end of 2013. Sonoma is targeting March of 2013 as a go-live date for their traffic component. And Santa Barbara, Placer, and Tulare are planning on deploying all case types. There is a sustained court consortium, if you will, user group. This group meets biweekly to discuss issues of all of the sustained courts. This is actually in line with one of the suggestions from the California Technology Agency, and that is post-CCMS that courts work together to create consortiums to use various vendor technologies in terms of e-filing, case management, and document management.
Thank you.
We also reviewed the progress of the court's protective order registry, which again has already been covered by Judge Jarre. So that concludes the Technology Committee's report.
Thank you, Judge Herman.
Thank you.
I see no hands raised. I take great comfort in that of all the reports given thus far and regularly, and those that are given by all the chairs, that only the Technology Committee chair, Judge Herman, does it from a computer. The rest of us rely heavily on our paper at this point, so we know that a culture change is definitely in order in the next few years. Thank you.
It is paperless.